Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
There is more material?
Well, there's a lot more, but we want to be paid first.
You are not ideological.
What is ideology?
I don't think so.
Look, I have a date, so...
Liberalism, conservatism,
Marxism, anarchism. If ideology is the air we breathe, how can we come to notice it?
The name of this trash can is ideology. The material force of ideology makes me not see what I'm effectively eating.
Would the world be a better place with less ideology?
One of the most ideological things that you can do is to say that you're being non-ideological.
Our guest is Marius Ostrovsky from the European University Institute in Florence.
Discredited and corrupt ideologies do not interest me.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
On Thursday, May 19th, come be part of a live taping of Philosophy Talk on the Stanford campus.
We'll be thinking about the changing face of anti-Semitism with historian Francesca Trivelato.
This event is free and open to the public. Everybody welcome. More information at philosophytalk.org.
That's Thursday, May 19th at 7 p.m. in Leventhal Hall at the Stanford Humanities Center.
We can't wait to see you there.
Are ideologies always wrong?
Can you subscribe to one without even knowing it?
Could we imagine a world without ideology?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you via the studios of KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today we're asking, what is ideology?
Well, that's easy, Ray. I mean, it's a false system of beliefs that's opposed to reason, you know, like fascism or Scientology.
Wait, you shouldn't tar all ideologies with the same brush. I mean, what about liberal democracy? That's the belief that everybody deserves the same freedom and a say in their government and the protection of the law. What's wrong with that ideology?
Well, nothing wrong with that, but it's not an ideology. It's just the truth.
Well, look, believing in liberal democracy isn't like believing in gravity. It's all fine and good to say physical facts are true, but values aren't like that. You and I value liberal democracy, sure, but that doesn't make it objectively true.
Well, hang on. A moment ago, you were agreeing that fascism is wrong.
Oh, yeah, wrong and false.
But you just said ideologies can't be true or false. So how can fascism be false, according to you?
Well, I only said ideologies can't be true. But they can be false because they can, you know, build in false assumptions. Fascists think that all problems are caused by foreigners, and that's just objectively false.
Okay, so let me see if I understand you. You're saying that ideologies can have false assumptions, but even if all the assumptions are correct, the ideology is still just a belief.
That's right.
Okay, so that seems fair enough. But still, don't we need a way to distinguish between bad ideologies like fascism and good ideologies like liberal democracy?
Well, sure. One is dangerous and harmful. You know, the other is beneficial for all of society.
So wait, are you saying it's true that liberal democracy is good for society?
Hey, it sounds like you think I'm contradicting myself.
Yeah, it definitely does sound that way. I mean, look, you said ideologies are never true. So how can you say it's true that liberal democracy is a good thing? Isn't that just your ideology talking?
Well, yeah, but that's okay. You can never get totally outside any ideology. It's the thing you use to understand the world. Without an ideology, you couldn't even think.
Well, that's a bit depressing. I don't want people to be wandering around trapped inside their ideologies, unable to see what's really happening in the world. Wouldn't we all be better off if we could ditch our distortions and get straight to grips with reality?
But ideology isn't a distortion. It's a framework. It helps you understand how all the little pieces fit together.
Well, I'm a big fan of frameworks, just not ideological ones. Look at all the damage that's being done in the name of ideology these days. Everyone getting all their information from social media, lobbing hand grenades at each other from within their ideological bubbles, tearing the country apart.
Yeah, I agree that those are huge problems. But guess what? The only way to solve them is a better ideology.
I knew you were going to say that.
Because it's true. There's no escape from ideology. And you can't do without it if you want to understand the problems we're all witnessing, like political partisanship, or racism, or climate change. If you don't have a theory, you're never going to have a solution.
Well, I don't know if that's true, but I bet our guest does.
Yeah, it's Marius Ostrovsky, author of a new book called simply Ideology.
We'll talk to him in a moment, but in the meantime, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Sarah Lee Sterland, to ask people what living in a different country made them realize about the ideology of their country of origin. She files this report.
So one thing is the fact that here it's common to talk about money, about personal finance, while in Italy it's absolutely a taboo.
Pancrazio Alteri is an Italian who has lived in the United States for more than a decade. Over time, he noticed that a big cultural difference between Americans and Italians is the way we approach finances.
Nobody talks about personal income and nobody asks about it. It's considered a big invasion of privacy, while in America it's normal to talk about finance, about personal investments, how to ensure income in retirement. In Italy, it's not really talked about, but that's because the government assumes more responsibility than individuals. And families take care of each other throughout life, so that grandparents paying for the kindergarten or for buying the first house for young couples. And it's enabled, I think, how the families stay together. So in America, it's very common to talk to people that left home when they were 20 or 19 going to college and never go back home. In Italy, the families, they keep in touch very often. The families are very connected. While in America, there is the student loan that it really starts that financial madness in the wrongest way possible. Don't start with a debt.
But why do Italians and Americans approach finances so differently in the first place? Could it be a difference between the American ethos of individualism and a European focus on community? Michelle Bene is a neighbor of mine in Los Gatos, California. She recalls being in Germany and feeling that it would be socially unacceptable to stick to an American habit.
I remember there being no traffic on the roads, but people were standing waiting to cross the road. They wouldn't cross unless there was a traffic sign that told them they could cross. And I thought, as an American, it was the most bizarre thing. We had to stand and wait while there were no cars until the light turned that we would cross the street. In Germany, the culture is to not really question authority. In America, we question authority, we express our emotions and our beliefs a lot more readily.
For Miriam Scoble, it was a move to San Jose, California from her native Iran in the 1980s that upended everything she took for granted in her universe.
My ideology changed in so many ways, one of which that I can exemplify was the way I thought about everyone from Iraq. I hated the Iraqis. They were bombing us. I lost cousins in war. My best friend's brother, 16-year-old brother, never came back. I always thought that if I ever meet someone from Iraq, that I'd want to kill them, that I just, you know, because they had taken away so much. And so when I came to the States, obviously those feelings were really strong. I was in high school, and one of my teachers said to me, oh, there are two sisters that just joined our high school and they're from Iraq. And since you're from the similar part of the world, I thought you should meet. And at first I was like, oh, I don't want to meet these people. Like, I was just so upset. And then I got to meet them and they were super sweet. And we had so many similarities that we had differences. They, of course, had lost family and friends to the war. And I think if I'd grown up in Iran, I would have been a lot more conservative, a lot more closed-minded, and would have kept a lot of resentment towards and a lot of biases towards an array of people based on what I was being taught in school based what I was experiencing every day and based on what the media was telling me. But travel, getting outside of your comfort zone, having different experiences, definitely opens your mind.
So perhaps the next time you disagree with someone, try to understand how they formed their ideology in the first place. Because after all, it's only when we can see these assumptions that we can change them. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Sarah Lye-Sterland.
Thanks for that great report, Sarah. Definitely makes me miss the old country. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. And today we're asking, what is ideology?
We're joined now by Marius Ostrovsky. He's a Max Weber Fellow at the European University Institute in Florence and author of a brand new book titled Ideology. Marius, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's an absolute pleasure to be with you.
So Marius, what first got you interested in ideology?
Well, I think the personal story for me here is that I used to be a very different ideology than I am now. I used to be quite a hardcore libertarian conservative. I would now describe myself as more of a democratic socialist, which is quite a large turnaround. Some people have other smaller turnarounds in their lives, but mine's probably quite one of the larger ones. And that kind of got me thinking that the things that I used to believe, I now dismiss. I think they're quite weird. They don't quite make sense to me anymore. The things I used to laugh at are ones I now believe. And that journey got me thinking about what it was, what are these frameworks that made me believe one thing, maybe believe the other thing? Can they be held against each other? Can they be united in some kind of way? And that made me think to engage with the topic of ideology in a little bit more detail, hence the book.
So in the framing, Josh and I were arguing about whether ideologies always have to be false. What do you think about that?
I think it's an excellent question. I think I fall more on the side that that ideologies are true as far as we are concerned, by which I mean that fundamentally reality or truth or what is out there, what we're operating in, is kind of unknowable to us just because it's quite complex. It is quite overwhelming. And we are fundamentally quite limited as human beings. We have quite, you know, our limited senses and things like that. And what we have to try and do is build maps, build things that make what we come across make sense to us. And that means simplifying things. That means picking out things that we think are important and neglecting things that are less important and building them into, for lack of a better word, a narrative, really, a telling of what's going on. And that telling is something which we use to orient ourselves in society. And it's necessary. And until, as you say, we get a better one, then we have to use the one that we're given.
So this point about ideologies being narratives sort of makes me wonder about sort of the limits of what counts as an ideology. So an example that I thought of is, I think that all objects have edges. Like my computer monitor has edges that if I reach out, I can like touch its edges and it sort of like lives between them. And that seems like a framework that I need to make sense of the world. And it seems like pretty complete, but it's not usually what I think of when I think of an ideology. Is it an ideology?
So I think there's kind of a broad and narrow way of approaching this. In the sense that it's a framework to help you make sense of the world, yeah, it is an ideology, but that's not necessarily what we always mean when we use the word ideology. We tend to mean it in a more social sense. We mean we're dealing with the interactions between people, between groups and society. So yeah, fine. It probably could be seen as that, but it's not perhaps the most pressing thing to be considered under that label.
Right. I mean, when I think of ideology, I think of things like fascism, progressivism, liberalism, conservatism, socialism.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Isms. Isms are the ones that we tend to think about in these terms. It's a classic shorthand. And ism is an ideology. Obviously not in all cases. Right. I mean, ageism, alcoholism, witticism, those aren't ideologies as such. But generally speaking, it's a shorthand.
But the other thing I often think of, I think of Marx's statement, you know, in all ideology, men and their circumstances appear upside down as in a camera obscura. So Marx had this idea that it was false, right? That part of the definition of an ideology is that it's an illusion. But it sounds like you don't agree with that.
I don't agree with that. I mean, I think there's a lot of value to be found in a lot of Marxist theory. But actually, if you simply look at that comparison, what he's trying to say is, look, you have ideology, which is driven by capitalist class interests, and then you have socialism, let's be clear, what about it, which is a scientific theory. Now, under our understandings, that's simply one ideology thinking that it's come up with a better way of describing reality than another ideology. To my mind, that's one ideology versus another, and we can have that argument about which one works better. But fundamentally, those are ideological positions all the same.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about ideology with Marios Ostrovsky from the European University Institute in Florence.
What explains the deep polarization we see around the world? Are ideological differences to blame? Does ideology get people to believe a bunch of lies?
How fictions breed factions, along with your comments and questions, when Philosophy Talk continues. When ideologies are clashing, what can we do about it? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're asking, what is ideology? With Marios Ostrovsky, author of a new book called Ideology.
We're pre-recording this episode, so unfortunately we can't take your phone calls. But you can always email us at comments@philosophytalk.org, or you can comment on our website. And while you're there, you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
So I think we can all agree that there's more polarization today than there has been in recent memory. Marios, is ideology to blame for that?
So what I find very interesting about this is that we've got times in our history when we've been less polarized. I would think that's a fairly uncontroversial thing to say. But we haven't been less ideological at that point. Simply what we've had is, if you think about all these different issues where you have binaries on, let's take for argument's sake, abortion or gay marriage or anything along those lines. Previously, you'd find people who'd fall into groups that would cross-cut each other. So you could have one position on one issue and another position on another issue, and it wouldn't necessarily correlate that much with each other. What we have now is a situation where you have all these binaries that correlate very strongly with each other. So the polarization part comes in is that if basically you believe one thing on one issue, you can probably predict what you're going to believe in all these other issues as well. And you have these ideological frameworks which have responded to that. They've partly created, but I think they've also responded to that by integrating it. A good example of that would be how the ideology of conservatism in the United States has actually responded to the Trumpist emergence and the particular issues that the Tea Party first raised, and everything since then has evolved in that direction. It's not necessarily been the driver. It's definitely captured it. It's definitely integrated it. It's definitely systematized it, and probably, if you like, made it worse. But that's also true. That's not necessarily, you know, a criticism of conservatism as such. That's simply how ideology works. It makes things into comprehensive frameworks. So that's how the kind of polarization has come about.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I remember reading one study from 2014 that showed that, you know, in 2004, 8% of Democrats were basically Democrats across the board, but that had gone up to 38%. And the Republicans, it went from 10% to 33%. And I assume that today the numbers are even higher. So, you know, it used to be the case, for example, that a Catholic might be anti-abortion, but also anti-death penalty. Which would place that individual a little bit between the two major parties in the United States.
That's exactly right. And I think
what happened?
Well, I think, well, to be, there's a very simple answer in the sense that the party system and the ideological system kind of mapped onto each other. And I think a good illustration of situations where that isn't the case is if you look at, well, Britain, for example, you have a much, I would say, a less extreme mapping in that kind of sense. I mean, yeah, there's probably polarizing tendencies there as well, but you also have people who sit in different parties who would actually sit very close together on the actual spectrum. Go across to continental Europe, you have an even more extreme case. Obviously, the electoral system helps on that front, and we can argue at length about why the electoral system makes polarization more of a thing, perhaps, in the United States than it does in other countries. But certainly, you have people who hold positions which are, they may fall into any party, really, but if they're placeable in ideological space, they could actually be quite close to one another.
So this might be naive of me, but I like to think that some of the questions that people are polarized on have correct answers. Like, either the death penalty is a good thing or it's a bad thing. Either we should keep it or do away with it. And the idea that your opinions about all of these questions ought to line up together seems a little bit worrying if you think that you're trying to get the right answer and that neither of the two factions has a monopoly on right answers. Is that a sensible worry on polarization? Like, are there right answers? Is there a reason that we should expect them to cluster the way that like political factions happen to cluster?
I think it's a fair question. I think ideology would resist the idea of right and wrong answers, you know, prima facie. But I think we can be a bit more ambitious in that respect, in the sense that we want to be able to say that there's something which is unambiguous, really. And I suppose what it comes down to is what works. And we have certain priorities which may or may not involve staying alive, the world not ending, and things like that in a catastrophic sense. But there's also more, you know, more basic ones like, is your situation okay? Are you in pain or are you not in pain? Are you experiencing, if you like, for lack of a better word, pleasure? So these are kind of very human, very material, almost very physical aspects of our existence. And in that sense, ideology should really be trying to serve that. And the question is then, is it or is it not doing that? I mean, I've wrestled quite a lot for a long time with the idea of, is there something out which can be safely placed outside ideology? I'm not even convinced that the stuff I've said can be, but I think it's the best chance that we have in that sense. And yeah, I think the problem of evidence is that evidence is always gathered in a way which is inherently already value-based. It's never value-free. So really the question becomes, what evidence are you gathering for what conclusion? And where is the line that you draw where the evidence of outcome ends? And as far as the death penalty, for example, goes, the question is less about whether or not it dissuades, which would be one side's argument about it. It's not a deterrent. It, you know, it doesn't work. It is highly racist in certain systems. The other side is simply, we don't care about that. We care about punishment. Mm. And there again, you have different priorities leading to different evidence being gathered. And as a result, different yeses and nos, different rights and wrongs, different truths and falses.
But it sounds like for some questions, you think maybe we could do without ideology, if I'm understanding you correctly. Let's just look at whether a given way of thinking about things and the policies that go along with that way of thinking about things make more people have a better life, right? You know, standard utilitarian way of thinking about things. Is the result that more people are living flourishing lives free of pain, or is it the opposite? Is that right? Is there a space where we could actually be free of ideology and just be sort of looking at the science and looking at the facts and making the best decision we can?
I'd like to say that, yes, we simply can, but it's very, very hard to get to that position without in turn adopting an ideological position of your own. And ultimately what we're trying to do is make sense of reality. That's really what it comes down to. And the points when there's not many points in our lives when we are outside ideology. The points when we realize that we are, if you like, inside and trying to step out of it is when something weird happens, something that we don't expect, something that makes absolutely no sense from the position from which we're approaching it. Another point is our early years, our, if you like, our neonatal years, before we've been formed, socialized into the person that we become. We're never born complete, are we? We become the person that we grow into. And we have a recollection of that. We remember the childish fantasies that we have. We remember playing in this limitless reality. Everything seemed possible. Every possible monster or fairy or whatever could possibly manifest. And then eventually we learn to constrain that into a more boring, bluntly, reality, a more boring understanding of reality. So if we want to step outside it, we have to recapture that slightly joyful, playful element. Perhaps not the answer we might think, but I think it's that element mixing with looking for the weirdnesses that leads us to the point where we kind of go, huh, I now realize where the limits of this ideology are and how we can step outside them.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about ideology with Marius Ostrowski from the Robert Schuman Center in Florence. So Marius, I'm still sort of trying to sort out this like truth and falsity question. So one thing that I might think is like, even if I can't retreat to a place where I'm able to think without ideology, still some ideologies are better, at least for some purposes, and some of them are worse. Like anti-vaccine sentiment, which I guess used to be a thing for the left wing in the US and now is a thing for the right wing in the US, seems bad from the standpoint of public health. And so I want to say, like, there's a serious error there. And whatever ideology doesn't have an anti-vaccine component, that one's better. Can I say that even if I can't say like ideologies are wholesale sort of evaluatable as true or false from some outside standpoint?
Well, I think fundamentally what makes an ideology effective, it is it allows us to navigate the world. And an ideology which tells us that viruses don't matter and that we don't need to worry about vaccines has a higher chance of leading to us dying of, in this case, COVID. That doesn't really count to me as navigating the world very well. So it's a map that takes us somewhere, but it has a greater chance of running into problems. So I think that's the kind of distinguishing factor. Yes, we probably can make judgments about that, but it's not a judgment that we can make from any kind of external position. It's kind of a run with it and see how far you can go type of position, which again is a matter of comparing being inside different ideological positions. But yeah, I think we can make judgments like that.
So, Marius, we've got a comment on our website from Mira. Mira asks, how do privately held ideologies play into our present global situation, given that the views of average citizens have little to no connection with policy decisions made by their political representatives?
That's a fascinating question. And I think we shouldn't fall into the trap, where I'm not saying that Mira has done anything wrong here. We shouldn't fall into the trap of merely thinking of ideology as to do with policy preferences. It's also to do with things we wouldn't necessarily think of as ideological. So the choices when we go to the supermarket, you know, what food we buy, what food we don't buy, what TV programs we watch, when we're on Hinge or Bumble or Tinder, whether we swipe right or left. These are all choices that have, if we pare away the layers of, if you like, normality, actually come down to some quite profound ideological choices about what's right and wrong, what's true and false, what's good and bad, good and evil, and things like that. So privately held ideologies are the personal, if you like, constellation of the different influences from different ideological sources which people have imbibed and sorted out into their own personal worldview. I would not say, just to be absolutely clear about this, someone who votes a certain way or considers themselves to have a certain worldview, a certain partisan view almost, is perfectly one ideology or perfectly another. It's very unlikely. We're all so involved in different areas of life. We have our families, we have our jobs, we live in certain areas, we have a certain nationality. All these different things mesh together to create a personal worldview which will have strong ideological content and might make us more one than another, but doesn't make us perfectly ever an ist, if you like, to join with a certain ism, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but I still wonder, you know, whether somebody is a perfect ist or a half that ist or whatever ratio they are, whatever degree they are. I'm very curious how people end up adopting the particular ideology they do, or in the case of someone like you, changing the ideology they have. I mean, you could think, based on things that Jonathan Haidt has said, for example, that ideologies differentially satisfy certain kinds of value that people have. And, you know, everyone has a range of values, and each of us considers some values more important than other values. And so you might think, oh, I look around at the options in front of me, and I instinctively pick the one that seems to maximize my highest values. Or you might think, yeah, it's whatever my parents told me, or whatever my church told me, or what my peers told me in school, or what the television tells me, or what, you know, what sitcoms seem to take for granted. And that's the most insidious stuff, right? That where the people aren't even telling you to believe it, they're just taking it for granted. That's really sticky. So is it one of those? Is it all of those? Where do people, how do people make those decisions about which ideology to subscribe to?
I think it's a very important question. I think I would contend that it's not in such a way that they have certain important values which they then convert into ideologies. The values are themselves already pretty ideological. The point is more that we're surrounded by all these different influences. You've listed them all. I won't repeat them again, but these are all things which are important in our lives. And it'll be a combination of disagreements, whether something essentially runs into problems as far as our own person is concerned. So a classic example of this would be beauty standards. So someone, a person of color, for example, when confronted with quite aggressive advertising based on essentially white-dominated, white supremacist, might I even say, beauty standards, will at some point say, but I don't have that. I am not that. I am the bit of reality which blocks off against the universal truth that this ideology is offering. And it'll be things like that which make people either, they can go one way or the other. Let's be clear, it can either be someone who then desperately tries to conform to the ideological standard that's being sold to them, or resists. And it's that moment of resistance where you suddenly go, hang on, I need to do something different. You've detached from whatever ideology you've had beforehand, and then what do? Are you in a non-ideological position? Perhaps very briefly, but that's quite a disorienting position to be in. You then try and latch onto a new ideological position. If there isn't one there, you make one. But it's very, very clear that there's moments of subjecting yourself and resisting. But the subjection comes first, and then the resistance can always come afterwards. And it's often to do with, essentially, when you yourself realize that the ideology isn't doing everything that it needs to, what it claims to be doing for you.
So Daniel has left a comment on our website asking about the difference between ideology and dogma. And he suggested that political platforms might be dogma rather than ideology. He says the difference is that ideology is a product of thinking, but dogma requires only conformity to some external authority. So where is the line between ideology and dogma, and how critical do you have to have been before it sort of counts as ideology rather than just dogma?
I think it's a very astute comparison, because a lazy way of putting it is that ideology is dogma and there's no more to it than that. I think certainly there are dogmatic forms of ideologies where, if you like, the thinking part has been quashed and all you're doing is parroting, replicating, repeating, simply manifesting the ideas without really reconsidering them. But ideology captures the critical part as well. It very much captures the reconsidering. And arguably, any time when you have uncritically applied ideas is dogmatic. But I think ideology as a category just sits in a much bigger space than that. And the development of theory and also the application of it is absolutely part of what ideology is and should be.
So your beauty standards example from a little while ago is another question for me, which is, how conscious does it have to be to count as ideology? So if I just think, look, I'd be better looking if I had straight hair and a smaller nose, but I don't ever think about why, or I just try to straighten my hair without like having a rationale for it, does that count as ideology?
I would say it's even more ideological than if it's more explicit. One of the most ideological things that you can do is to say that you're being non-ideological or apolitical or anything along those lines, or neutral or just factual, all these different things. That is, what you're trying to do is to shut out the existence of any other truth, which means that if you allow for the existence, say, oh, well, there's one party, there's another party, perfectly fine, we can argue about tax levels or, you know, rights, whatever else. But if you are saying, no, there's no alternative, then what you're saying is, my ideology is the truth, and you're disguising the fact that it's ideological. That is one of the most manipulative things you can do, and obviously ideology specializes in that. So the more unconscious it is, the more interesting it is from an ideological perspective.
So then I might not even know that I'm doing it. How do I get myself out of that situation?
I think a certain measure of, if you like, counterexample is quite helpful. And we heard from the roving reporter earlier of the shift between one context and another context. I think that is exactly the kind of thing which gets people to think about the ideology they have. I mean, speaking as a Brit now going in Italy and, you know, having been to America in the past, you can tell ideological differences, which doesn't mean that you are in some way outside ideology, but what you are is a different ideology, and you see how these contrasts exist. So really, what it comes down to is meeting someone who goes, hang on, that doesn't make any sense. Hang on, that's a bit odd. Hang on, why do you do that? And it's that part when you kind of go, well, actually, why do I do that? Why haven't I questioned this before? And that's the part when you start becoming more conscious of the ideological levels going on.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're asking, what is ideology? With Marius Ostrovsky from the European University Institute.
Would the world be a better place with less ideology? Or is the best way to fight ideology better ideology? What can we do to stop bad ideologies from taking over?
Ideas, ideals, and ideologies. Plus a question from our community of thinkers when Philosophy Talk continues. If you're knee-deep in ideology, how can you know what's real? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Marius Ostrovsky from the European University Institute. And we're asking, what is ideology?
So Marius, we were talking in the last section about the damage that bad ideology can do to democracy. So what do you think we can do about it?
So I think this is a quite interesting question because the idea of democracy itself sits within an ideological framework as well. Naturally, there's different definitions of democracy depending on whether you ask a liberal, a conservative, a socialist, and so on. But of course, democratism, if you want to give it that name, is an ideology in its own right, and it's committed to certain views of what society should be structured like, what institutions should be, and so on. At the same time, we also have to ask about different versions of what badness and dangerousness is. It's also an ideological claim to say those things about any ideology. And it would be no surprise to know that a fascist would strongly disagree about their badness or their dangerousness. In fact, they would say the absolute opposite is true. They would say that it's the liberal, or it's the socialist, or the communist who's the bad or the dangerous person. But I think it's one of the things to go back to is, what is ideology doing for people? Is it leading to, if you like, our better ability to engage with reality, to make sense of it, to navigate it, or is it worsening it? Is it making it less effective? And there's catastrophic ways of doing that. So I would categorize ideologies that embrace climate destruction or nihilism in that sense as absolutely bad, because they will destroy the reality we try and engage with, or at least destroy us in our engagement with it. So that's quite hard to justify as a good ideology in that sort of sense. But we really have to be careful when we throw these terms around. Ultimately, it's a matter of good and bad for whom, dangerous and helpful for whom. But within that context, we can still make a judgment about how good are these forms of thought, how good are these patterns at helping us get on with our lives effectively.
So some ideologies are going to disagree with each other about who the relevant people are, whose welfare matters. So if I'm a nationalist, I might think only people from my country matter, you know, screw the rest of the world. If I'm really aligned with my economic class, I might not mind stomping on the people below me. If I'm a humanist, I might think all humans matter, but I might or might not like care about non-human animals. Is there a way to resolve those disagreements, I mean, among ourselves, within ourselves?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's in many ways ideologies do. So, for example, the creation of ideologies like social democracy and Christian democracy were kind of attempts to resolve differences between conservatives and socialists, between liberals and socialists, and a way to sort of think, well, hang on a minute, we've got ultimately contesting claims about what certain values mean, which ones are more important. Well, let's try and find a way of bridging these. And actually, putting my academic hat on, that's what got me interested. You know, I worked on social democracy as an ideology which went from absolutely nowhere to the dominant form of progressive ideology. How did that happen? Well, because it very successfully managed to actually resolve some of these disagreements in a way that persuaded people, in a way that worked. I mean, the classic claim there was only revolution will overturn the bad things about society and make a good society come about, versus the society we have right now is perfectly fine. And in that context, social democracy said, well, hang on a minute, we can combine these. We don't have to overturn everything. We can reform within it. And it turned out that worked. It turns out it made people's lives better. So that's the proof is in the pudding, is almost the way of framing how ideologies can solve these issues.
That's really interesting because I'm really curious about how people get swept up in an ideology, how people's minds get changed. And obviously, this is a really pressing question. In a moment when a lot of people seem to be going down some pretty scary rabbit holes. How do we get them out of those rabbit holes? You know, what kind of, I don't know, trying to continue the metaphor, what kinds of carrot do you have to hold up above the hole? Because, you know, on the one hand, you're saying, look, some ideologies are actually persuasive and they can tempt people towards things that seem actually to map on better to the way the world actually is. But I sort of worry, you know, for a couple of reasons. One is that ideologies very often tend to be implicit. We were saying that before. We're not aware of them until maybe we travel to a different country or something like that. Fish don't know the water they're swimming in. And the other reason is ideologies are often very well defended. So if you bring up contrary evidence, people say, oh, that's just false consciousness if they're a Marxist, or that's just denial if they're Freudian, or that's just the deep state. All right. So very often they're you know, not falsifiable, as Karl Popper would say. They're very well defended. They can account for anything that goes against them. How do we get people into what you were saying? I love what you said earlier about the weirdnesses. When you notice the weirdnesses of your own ideology, that's a kind of productive moment. But how do we get people there if the ideologies are so defended?
Well, a simple answer in a sense is ideological pluralism. And it's simply to have, well, one of the most powerful theoretical concepts is what's called essential contestation. And that's a very long-winded way of saying you have a concept, we argue about what it means. So the idea of freedom, let's take that for example. For a socialist or a communist, perhaps a social democrat, freedom means emancipation. For a conservative or libertarian, it means free enterprise, for example. Today, it might also mean free speech. And you argue about the limits and parameters of this particular concept, which ones matter, which ones don't, which ones should be prioritized, and so on. And the argument there is to use these conceptual debates. Now, I'm not saying these are debates in a debating society type sense. These are fundamentally very practical arguments, which are often done through demonstration. As I said, proof is in the pudding, as it were. That's how you convince people. You don't merely psychologically persuade them, even emotionally persuade them. You physically prove that what you're saying and doing actually works and makes sense. In that context, having a pluralistic system means that an ideology can shine very specific laser-like lights on the areas where it's enemy ideologies or its rival ideologies are a bit less robust. All ideologies are well defended. There's obviously institutions and often very powerful thinkers defending all of them. But no one's armor is perfect. Why? Because reality is changing the whole time. Ideologies can be superseded. And it's often the subtle changes that are going on underneath, bubbling underneath the surface, that lead to ideologies becoming weaker because they're thinking of reality in terms that no longer apply. And that's where these arguments essentially come into. That's where these arguments become ideological. We're not just arguing over definitions of values. We're arguing over what systems that realize these values have to be set up in order to work, basically.
That makes sense. And of course, it's a tall order to ask somebody to abandon an ideological position entirely. But I'm sort of wondering whether we could make any headway getting people just a little bit less, you know, tenaciously clinging to the entire package deal of an ideology. And, you know, I can see why ideologies are, in that sort of strong sense, are tempting, because first of all, they give you a group identity, sometimes a national identity. Some people want that. And secondly, you know, they explain everything, right? They're a key to all mythologies. And you look at any phenomenon, if you're a good Marxist, you're like, aha, I understand that, you know. So how can we tempt people to just turn down the volume a little bit and say, yeah, you know, I tend to see it in this way, but I can also understand other points of view. And here's a part I'm really committed to, but here's a part that I'm not totally sure about.
I think that's kind of where, if a sort of slightly critically minded ideology theorist has anything to contribute, I think it's probably that. It's encouraging people to actually be honest about how little we do know about what's going on around us. So I think it's quite important to be intellectually humble, especially so for academics, of course, but I mean, everyone should be in that kind of position. And it's okay to not be sure. It's essentially the message we want to impress on people. By all means, be committed to the position that you have. You can be fervently committed to it, but just be aware and remember in the back of your head that you may eventually be proved wrong. And even if you aren't proved wrong, at some point your position might just change because situation requires it. So no idea is forever, no ideology is forever. And I think that kind of message has to be the one that we send to people.
I totally agree with you. I think that was absolutely true and entirely non-ideological. On that note, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
And thank you so much for inviting me. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Our guest has been Marius Ostrowski, Max Weber Fellow at the Robert Schuman Center in Florence, and author of the brand new book, Ideology. So Ray, what are you thinking now?
So I have a book to recommend to our listeners, which is Kaylin O'Connor and Jim Weatherall's book, The Misinformation Age, How False Beliefs Spread, which sort of tracks the social dynamic of alternative facts in recent years.
sadly timely and extremely important. We're going to put links to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on the blog or answer it at the end of the show.
Thinking of which, here's a great question we got from one of our listeners. It's time for a question from the community.
Oh, who are the people in your neighborhood? In your neighborhood.
Mira asks about the geometry of the classroom. So in a standard classroom, there's a front, a middle, and a back, and that affects the way teaching goes. Do you have thoughts about that, Ray?
Yeah, that's a really good observation, Josh. I think it does affect the way that teaching goes. And I think if you're not careful, the education research actually shows that there are about 6 or 8 students who will participate in class all the time, and then everybody else will be like, all right, it's their responsibility to ask questions, and won't get the chance to ask a question, won't get to practice that. And as a teacher, you kind of have to make active choices to stop that from happening.
And is that about the geography? I mean, are they the ones who's sitting at the front or the side, or how does that intersect?
Yeah, so I think I'm actually unclear. Like, I know that if I just go with my impulses, I will call on students who are sitting not to the left or to the right, but to the center, because I see them first. So whoever's in my direct line of vision, I'm more likely to call on if left to my own devices. I think some people sit in the back of the classroom because they don't want to talk, and some people sit in the front because they do want to talk. But that's not always. Like, sometimes the kid who wants to talk is sitting like in the middle or off to the side or in the back.
It's something that was very interesting in the era of online teaching. I mean, I didn't love it, but that was one silver lining, was a certain democratization of the teaching space, that everyone, there's no one at the front, there's no one at the back. Everyone's square is exactly the same size. The professor's square is the same size as everybody else's. Is that how it felt to you too?
It did. I really liked that it made it easy to keep track of what everybody's name was and who had a question and whose question was first and last in the queue.
Do you feel like it encouraged people to speak?
No. I feel like it discouraged people from speaking because they were speaking into a camera and I had to do things to work to encourage them to speak and participate.
Of course, if it's a seminar, the geography of the classroom presumably is our friend, because very often we sit in a circle or at worst around a table. And yeah, maybe the professor's at the head of the table. That's not the worst thing in the world. But everyone else hopefully feels very much, you know, on an equal footing with everybody else.
Yeah, I love the sitting in a circle. And I'm just thinking of another trick that I've seen our former co-host Ken Taylor use that was wonderful in one of his classes. So he would do this thing, I forget what he called it. It was like volleyball or something. And he would say something and he would like toss the question to a student. I don't think he had a physical volleyball, but it was like an imaginary volleyball that he would toss to a student. And the only rule was that the student had to respond to something that he said and then toss the volleyball to a different student. And you're supposed to spread it around. And then that student had to respond to what the previous person said and toss the ball to the next student. And I think it took a lot of the pressure off. Like, there wasn't really a sense of getting it wrong. It was like, I heard you, I had a thought, who is the next person? And it got people talking to each other.
Oh, that's lovely. So then the students are encouraged to echo a little bit the last thing that they heard. So it's not just a series of monologues, but people are listening and people are co-creating some thought or set of thoughts that's bigger than the sum of its parts. I think this is lovely. And it's sort of a form of cold calling, but less tyrannical, right? Because it's not the professor who's throwing the imaginary volleyball. It's the student A or B or C throwing passing the ball along, and everyone gets a turn. And hopefully it's not quite as scary for people who are not as big on contributing. And to get back to the thing you were saying earlier, that one person who wants to spend the entire class talking, they don't get to do that. They don't get the ball.
It's super important. That person is valuable, but they're not more valuable than everybody else in the class.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW San Francisco Bay Area and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2022.
Our executive producer is Ben Trefney. The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from subscribers to our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
I mean, say what you want about the tenets of National Socialism, dude. At least it's an ethos.